From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. There is some good news on the economic front today. New weekly unemployment claims fell to 360,000, marking a new low since the pandemic ripped through the economy more than a year ago. Fed Chair Jerome Powell spoke about jobs this morning before the Senate Banking Committee. He was on Capitol Hill for the second of 2 days of testimony before Congress.
Job gains should be strong in coming months as public health conditions continue to improve and as some of the other pandemic-related factors currently weighing them down diminish.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley has been listening to Powell's testimony, and he joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Peter.
These new unemployment numbers were pretty timely for Powell as he talks about the economy and Fed policy. Put those numbers into context for us.
Yeah, the weekly claims data have been showing improvement for several weeks now. As you say, state claims were down to 360,000 last week. That was a drop of about 26,000 from the previous week. Claims under the special federal program for gig workers and the self-employed were also down to about 96,000. And if you look at the total number of people who are collecting any form of unemployment, during the week of June 26th, that fell to 13.8 million, down about 370,000 from the previous week. What that shows is both that there's been an improvement in the job market and more people finding work. It also reflects the fact that a number of states have now prematurely ended the special pandemic unemployment benefits, and so that's showing up in the decline in the total number of people getting help as well.
And at the same time, inflation has reached its highest level in 13 years. Lawmakers have been pressing Powell on the recent spike in prices that we're all paying at the grocery store and at the gas station. It seems like his overall message is that this inflation will be temporary, but how is he backing that up?
Well, you're right. We are seeing higher prices at the grocery store and the gas station, but we're really seeing them at the used car lot. The price of used cars was up more than 10% between May and June. And it's been a big contributor to the overall inflation. It accounts for about a third of overall inflation during that month. And that's really a byproduct of the problem we've seen with semiconductors in the new car market. So a lot of people are buying used cars who ordinarily would like to buy a new car, and that's pushing up the price. And it's that kind of bottleneck throughout the economy that's really, at least in the Fed's view, driving this surge in inflation. What we're seeing is that demand has come back very strongly as more people have gotten vaccinated and they're shopping and traveling and doing the things they couldn't do during the worst of the pandemic. And businesses are just having trouble ramping up to keep pace with that. And that's a recipe for higher prices. The Fed believes that as businesses catch up and as some of that sort of pent-up demand, that surge in demand returns to more normal levels, we should see these prices and price hikes revert to something close to the Fed's long-term target of 2%.
Why don't we hear from Senator Bill Hagerty, a Republican from Tennessee, who spoke earlier this morning.
People in Tennessee are seeing their buying power eroded like never before, and they don't see this as transitory.
So how is Powell responding to a concern like that? And what do lawmakers want the Fed to do, if anything?
Well, there's certainly no question that Republicans in Congress and Republicans on the campaign trail hope to make a political issue of this. It's, the Biden administration is getting generally good marks for their handling of the economy, but Republicans hope to use higher inflation as sort of a cudgel against the Biden administration. They are suggesting that this higher levels of inflation are a result of the congressional spending, and they're hoping to head off additional spending that the White House is pushing for. What the Fed is keeping a close eye on are inflation expectations, because if people do come to think that prices are just going to keep climbing, then they will demand higher wages, and businesses might keep raising prices to pay those higher wages, and you could get into a 1970s-style spiral. That's not what the Fed says they're seeing right now. And certainly if you look at the bond market, it doesn't look as if investors who are betting with their own money expect those price hikes to continue indefinitely. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen did an interview with NPR this morning where she said, look, it's not something that's going to be resolved in a month or two. So temporary doesn't mean it's going to go – prices are going to level off, next week or next month, but maybe by the end of the year, we should see a return to more normal pricing levels.
Another issue that is a lot of people concerned is the price of housing. What did we hear from Chairman Powell on that issue today?
Well, it's certainly true that housing prices have been going up. That's a result of both strong demand. You know, a lot of people who've been spending more time at home have decided they want a little more space. Maybe they want to be have a little more yard or whatnot. So there is strong demand. There's not a lot of housing on the market, and so prices have certainly been going up. And with interest rates at really rock bottom levels, that's enabled more people to spend more for housing. That's really challenging for people who are trying to get into the market for the first time, but it's not directly a factor in the inflationary numbers that we're seeing.
Yeah. All right. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
Always good to talk to you, Peter.
Hairstylists and barbers know a lot about their clients, so much so that a new Tennessee law passed during the pandemic and scheduled to take effect next year will require them to recognize signs of domestic violence. Advocates say the new law saves lives by teaching stylists what to say and not to say to clients in need. Natasha Senyonovich has the story, which was produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center and Nashville Public Radio.
Longtime Nashville hairstylist Betsy Briggs Cathcart has had many clients with alopecia, a type of patchy hair loss. But one in particular had a form she'd never seen before.
What I realized through the training is that I think her husband was pulling her hair from the back and pulling it out from the abuse.
The training she refers to was created for beauty industry professionals by Nashville's YWCA, which runs the largest emergency shelter in the region. The training gives an overview of the physical, emotional, and financial dynamics of intimate partner abuse. A few years ago, Briggs Cathcart began hosting the sessions in her salon, BBC. She found it important for several reasons.
Especially when I learned that we are one of the people that the abusers will let the victims still come to.
Because intimate partner abuse so often hinges on isolating someone from friends and family. And hairdressers are already used to hearing secrets, says Suzanne Post.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard someone say, I've never told someone this, or I can't believe I just said that.
Post is another longtime Nashville stylist and a survivor of abuse. She got the YW to create the training for a program she launched in 2017 called Sheerhaven. She also supplies salons with brochures on domestic violence resources. Post says beauty professionals are uniquely poised to see injuries victims may be hiding, like bruises or hair that's been pulled out. But that's only one part of domestic violence, which is about power and control. So, she says, there are other signs to watch for.
It might be that their partner comes with them to every appointment or is always waiting in the car. Or maybe someone is very uncomfortable about making a change because they're afraid of what their partner might think.
The information can also help with recognizing potential abusers, says Jamal Stewart, the owner of Master's Barbershop in Nashville. He remembers one client who was overly vigilant of his girlfriend.
She sat out in the car if he came in, got a cut, or he might bring her in, depending on how many people were in. Or, you know, kind of just, yeah. So I guess that would be an identifier.
Those are the kinds of aha moments that the YW training was meant to inspire, says Suzanne Post. Then she realized it could be done on a much larger scale.
I heard about legislation that had been passed in Illinois that was around this issue.
In 2017, that state began requiring beauty professionals to get domestic violence training. So Post and the YWCA found lawmakers to sponsor similar legislation in Tennessee. But the bill stalled last year. Before COVID even, because lawmakers wanted the training to be free and virtual to reach even the state's most rural areas.
We didn't know how that would happen. We didn't have Zoom. I mean, we hadn't embraced Zoom yet.
But when everything moved online during the pandemic, Post found a way to get the bill passed this year. She reached out to King Research, the company that makes Barbicide. That's the blue disinfectant found in barbershops and hair and nail salons. Hundreds and thousands of industry professionals and students already take Barbicide's online infection control training. Leslie Rosti, the company's education director, says adding a 20-minute video to their platform on domestic violence was a no-brainer.
I said, well, absolutely. As long as it would be open to everybody who comes to our website and that it's free of charge, we're fine doing it.
Since the YW video was launched in October, more than 25,000 people have been certified worldwide. And Rosti says another 10 states are working on legislation similar to Tennessee's. Because at least one in four women and one in seven men will experience domestic violence, She says building awareness is vital. But Rosti is very clear that the certificate does not make beauty professionals mandatory reporters of abuse, like, say, teachers.
We are not giving someone all this information and making them feel responsible for somebody else. Certainly that's not, you know, what they signed up for when they decided to be a cosmetologist.
What they are signing up for is to listen and be empathetic if someone says they're being hurt or controlled by a partner. Because domestic violence victims must be able to leave their abusers safely. So the most important tools a stylist or anyone can give them are shelter and hotline numbers to call to get the professional help they need. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinyanovich.
Some 24 Republican-led states have either passed or proposed restrictions on how systemic racism is talked about in schools. They argue that critical race theory is divisive and teaches kids that white people are inherently racist. Critical race theory is an academic term. The concept is built around a legal framework that Democrats say critics are distorting. They add that the concept is not even taught on the K-12 level. This fight is now drawing the attention of the nation's largest teachers union. Joining us now is the president of the National Education Association, Becky Pringle. Becky, welcome to Here and Now.
It's good to be with you, Don.
These laws tend to target critical race theory specifically. If teachers are not even teaching critical race theory, how do these kinds of laws hurt teachers?
Well, first of all, we know that this is a political attempt to distract attention away from those politicians who have for decades denied our schools and our students the resources they need. We cannot allow them to stoke that fear or divisiveness in an effort to either curtail voting rights or to diminish our democracy. And we have to be clear about what is happening and what they're using it to do. But we know that that could have a chilling effect on our students' ability to have access to a rich and full, complete curriculum. Our kids are so much smarter and more prepared than many adults give them credit for, and we can't shortchange them. I have an eight-year-old grandson who asked me lots of questions when he had to do a report on his family's history. And I talked about my grandfather being enslaved right in Charlottesville, Virginia. And as he asked me questions about that and how it not only impacted then as part of history, but how it was impacting him now, even as an eight-year-old. And eight-year-olds around this country are asking questions about what's happening right now. And they can wrestle with these issues. And guess what, Don? They can tackle them together.
And that means teaching about a subject like racism directly in high school, in middle school, but also in elementary school and at the earliest level?
With our students, even at the earliest levels, we are teaching them about valuing and respecting each other. And to value and respect their classmates, they need to know about those struggles around where there are inequities in systems. And by the way, Don, our kids see it. They see it. They know when, for example, they are competing in a sports event against a team that's a mile down the road, and they go to that school, and that public school has everything from an Olympic-sized swimming pool to all of the technology. They see the inequities in the systems. And it is important for them to understand why it is that some students have and some students don't. So that they, as they ask those questions and they realize that's not right and it's not fair, that they, as citizens of this country, have the opportunity as they grow into adults, have the opportunity to vote, have an opportunity to run for office, have an opportunity to participate in our democracy, that they have the information they need so they can make decisions about how we finally dismantle those inequities throughout all of the social systems in this country.
What do you say to parents who feel like they should have a great deal of input, even control over what's taught in their local schools. What do you say to parents who feel like the classroom is not the place for these kinds of conversations?
You know, Don, we at the NEA have a very close partnership with our parent organizations, and our educators have close relationships with and partnerships with parents in the communities. And we welcome those conversations with them to ensure that their students are prepared with the information, that complete information, comprehensive information, and that they are allowed to grow and thrive.
So some teachers, depending on where they are, if they add this to their classroom lectures or their study plans, they may be taking a risk. What tools do you have to defend teachers when it comes to being able to educate students along these lines, especially if we're talking about some of the youngest students?
Well, of course, we are going to provide guidance and support for all of our affiliates and all of our members. If in any way their rights are being threatened, or if they are being threatened, but we are arming them with information, not only information about what's happening in their states, information about the laws, which vary from state to state. And then making sure that we're beating back any pundits and politicians that are just using this as a wedge issue to try to either take away voting rights from people in this country, or try to isolate their own power in ways that are not in the best interest of our students, and honestly, are not in the best interest of this country.
Are you anticipating legal battles over this to protect your teachers, your members?
That very well may happen, and if it does, we will be ready.
Becky Pringle is president of the National Education Association. Becky, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Don.
If you are tired of that goldfish swimming in circles in your aquarium, please take the advice of wildlife experts in Minnesota. Do not throw the fish into a lake. Officials in Burnsville, Minnesota, recently shared pictures of some incredibly fat goldfish that had been found in the wild. Drew Youngdyke is a conservation expert at the National Wildlife Federation. He's in Michigan. Drew, welcome. Have you seen the size of these goldfish they're pulling out of this lake?
Yes, I have. And it's pretty alarming, because we're certainly used to seeing maybe the small few inch-sized goldfish, but they can certainly grow that large in the wild when they're exposed to that kind of food resource.
Yeah, now they're the size of a football in this lake. How do they get that big?
Well, you know, what they do is really the same thing that any non-native species or invasive species does as an ecosystem, is they get into a new ecosystem, they eat the food resources that are available. And of course, those food resources that they eat are now no longer available to native species like fish and frogs and that kind of thing.
Where do these fish come from?
They come from parts of China, but, you know, they've become pet fish and ornamental fish. And of course, they're in the United States, obviously, as pets, but they get into the wild then when people release them.
If this is someone's pet, why would they decide to release them into a lake?
You know, it's hard to say why an individual might, but of course they shouldn't. And if somebody can't take care of it, you know, maybe they got it as a pet for their kid and their kid isn't quite ready to take care of it, find another home for it, as somebody who can't take care of it, take it to an aquarium. But whatever you do, please do not release it into wild waters.
Okay, well, why? What kind of damage do these goldfish do when they get that big and they're swimming around in a local lake?
There's what one fish can do, but when there's multiple of them and they get a nice little population going, they can really root out the bottom structure of an aquatic ecosystem. Then there's the actual food resources that they consume. They're opportunistic feeders. They eat little plants and little insects, crustaceans. And so when they eat those food resources, those are no longer available to the native fish and the native frogs in that aquatic ecosystem.
How widespread is this problem across the country?
This happens, I think, in a few different lakes in Minnesota that I'm aware of. It can really happen anywhere that somebody releases it.
Oh, well, this problem was so bad in one nearby lake in Minnesota that the Washington Post is reporting officials pulled out up to 50,000 goldfish from the water in a single day. So how difficult is it to solve this problem once they get established in a local ecosystem?
That's the problem with invasive species. Once they get into an ecosystem, it's almost impossible to eradicate them from that ecosystem. The best solution is prevention. So whether that's invasive carp and doing the infrastructure projects that keep them out of the Great Lakes ecosystem, or if it's something like goldfish, the prevention is just don't release them in the wild.
And when you say infrastructure projects, what do you mean by that?
Sure. So for invasive carp, we're talking mainly about the Brandon Road Lock and Dam Project in Illinois. With invasive carp, rather than people release them individually, they're imported through aquaculture facilities in the South, and they've been steadily making their way up through the Mississippi River system. So these are projects that would keep them from being able to pass through the connections between the Mississippi River system and the Great Lakes watershed.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that they're building dams to keep invasive carp out of the Great Lakes? That sounds like a huge investment, and makes me think that this is more than just a small little problem. This is serious.
This is a massive problem. It's really wrecked fisheries throughout the South and the Mississippi River system. So they really have a tremendous impact, whether it's invasive carp or their smaller cousins, goldfish, when they get into little ponds like this. And it really just goes to the fact that we need to do our best to keep species that don't belong in an ecosystem out of it through prevention first. Otherwise, it becomes this big expensive problem if we let them in.
All right. Well, we are hearing you loud and clear. The message is, do not put your pets into the lake. Drew Youngdyke is a conservation expert at the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Investigations into police use of force and misconduct were secret in California until now. We've sifted through hours of interrogation tape to find out who does the system of police accountability really serve and who does it protect. Listen now to every episode of the new podcast, On Our Watch, from NPR and KQED.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said this week that it's time to end a federal prohibition on marijuana. Most congressional Democrats agree, and so do a growing number of Republicans. The trouble is lawmakers don't see eye to eye on how to do it. Callum Borchers from member station WBUR reports on that partisan divide and what's at stake for businesses caught in the middle.
Schumer hasn't always been an ally of marijuana enthusiasts, but now he's pledging to use the power of his office to lift the federal cannabis ban.
We're going to fight to make sure it happens. My thinking, of course, like so many others, has evolved on the issue.
The majority leader wants to clear some criminal records and impose a marijuana sales tax. Some of the money would fund a special program for cannabis entrepreneurs from neighborhoods targeted in the war on drugs. The plan is similar to a House bill called the MORE Act, which stands for Marijuana Opportunity, Reinvestment, and Expungement. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts is a co-sponsor, and she says the lucrative marijuana marketplace must welcome people of color.
People who were disproportionately locked up and now being locked out of a multi-billion dollar industry.
The push to legalize marijuana at the federal level has Republican backers, like Congressman Dave Joyce of Ohio, but he's co-sponsoring a narrower plan that would regulate marijuana like alcohol and enable the VA to prescribe cannabis treatments to veterans. Joyce argues that what Democrats bill as a restorative justice program would be unfair to other business owners.
You're going to tax the people who went in the industry and followed the laws of their state. And we're going to then wipe the slate clean for all the people who've been in the black market against them and then subsidize them to now get in business against them? That doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
Joyce notes that under his plan, states would be free to tax marijuana or launch social justice programs on their own. And some already have. Leah Samora used an equity initiative in Massachusetts to get her license for a recreational marijuana store near the Harvard campus in Cambridge. There's a certain irony to the location.
First, I think to be a black woman in Harvard Square with a cannabis shop that used to be a police station, I think it's just an amazing opportunity.
That's right. When Samora opens Yamba Boutique this fall, she'll be selling weed at a former outpost for local cops. Bringing her business to the verge of opening has not been easy. Cannabis may be legal in Massachusetts, but the federal prohibition makes banks wary of issuing business loans. So Samora turned to a private investor named Sean Hope. He's a successful attorney and real estate developer, but the new marijuana venture is a stretch even for him.
Thankfully, we were able to partner together. I've essentially leveraged my family's worth in real estate to be able to participate, but there's tremendous risk.
Lifting the federal cannabis ban could reduce the risk by easing bank lending. It could also bring the law in line with public opinion. In a recent Pew poll, 91% of American adults said marijuana should at least be legal for medical use, and 60% backed recreational use. Plus, the vast majority of states have legalized medical or recreational marijuana already. But a bipartisan deal doesn't look imminent, and it remains unclear what President Biden, a cannabis skeptic, would be willing to sign. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about that.
Well, the president supports leaving decisions regarding legalization for recreational use up to the states.
That sounds a bit like the status quo. Psaki added Biden wants to remove federal criminal penalties for marijuana possession, but it's possible that even if a full legalization bill makes it through Congress and reaches his desk, the president might veto it. For NPR News, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
Overnight, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel shouldered some of the blame for the recent unrest on the island. He acknowledged some government responsibility for the food and power shortages that have sparked historic protests and promised to lift restrictions on some imports like medicine and other essentials. Anti-government activists say at least 200 people have been detained or are missing. At least one person was killed in clashes with police. The unrest has also put pressure on the Biden administration to turn its attention to U.S. policy in Cuba. Joining us now is Dario Moreno. He is professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University in Miami. Dario, welcome. It is good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
Just a few days ago, the Cuban president was telling people loyal to the government to go fight protesters in the streets. Why do you think he's softening his tone here?
Well, because I think the situation is, from the perspective of the Cuban government, very fluid and very dangerous. I mean, what makes this an unusual protest is first its size and scope, that it's in multiple cities. And secondly, the fact that it's the first major crisis without a Castro in charge of Cuba. So Díaz-Canel is fighting two battles, one with the protesters and the other to keep his power. The Castro family and the hard right in Cuba, the hard conservatives in Cuba, are watching Díaz-Canel closely.
Let me ask you, because I've heard several people make this point, that there's no Castro in control of Cuba right now. How do you think Raul or Fidel, if he were still alive, how would they have handled this crisis?
It's not really a question of how they will handle it, but that the Castros had so much legitimacy in Cuba as sort of the leaders of the revolution. They had a tremendous amount of credibility among the Cuban people, even though people lived in very difficult situations. What they're missing is this tremendous historic figure of the Castro brothers, who have been leading Cuba since 1959. It's sort of like when Khrushchev replaced Stalin, or the change of generations in the Soviet Union. And that's what we're seeing in Cuba.
Well, the president is now promising to lift import restrictions so that Cubans can bring supplies or medicine back into the country when they travel. There is a promise now to improve the failing power grid. Do you think some of these changes that he's promising to make are enough to calm the anger?
I think we can make two mistakes here. One is to view that things are going to change very quickly, because transitions take a long time. Look at the process in the Soviet Union. Look at the process in Poland, in Eastern Europe. It took 7 years from the founding of Solidarity to the collapse of the communist regime in Poland. So we're seeing now could be the beginning of the end, but it's only the beginning. Second point I would make is that the crisis in Cuba is far deeper than just electricity and getting supplies. Those things will certainly relieve a bit of the suffering. The problem is sort of this feeling of hopelessness that the Cuban people have. Things haven't improved. Things are getting worse. In January, they made currency reforms, which led to runaway inflation. COVID is out of control, though we don't know about it. The situation with the United States has gotten worse, not better. Remember in 2016, there was great hope in Cuba when Obama came down. And there was hope that things will change, that U.S.-Cuban relations will improve. But the Cubans did not give the United States anything in terms of improving human rights, in terms of improving the situation with the people, in terms of moving toward a more rational economic system. So the results have been is they blew that golden opportunity. And now if you talk to people in Cuba, what you get is a sense of hopelessness. There is a Cuban expression, desobed, which means resolve. You live resolving each day today. You don't think about the future.
Hmm. Well, those feelings of hopefulness may have also been dashed when President Trump came into office and tightened the clamp after Obama had loosened it. Right. And Diaz-Canel has been putting most of the blame for this violence on the U.S. government and its politics, as he says, of economic asphyxiation. What do you think about that? I mean, what role do U.S. policies play here?
You know, as far as inside Cuba, very little. The issue in Cuba is their own economic policies. Look, the Cubans had an opportunity to improve relations with the United States. And what did they do? They attacked the American diplomats in Cuba in these so-called sonic attacks, which caused medical conditions in some of our diplomats, including a small child that was a dependent on one of the diplomats. And there are lawsuits now in U.S. courts regarding what happened in Cuba. And the Cuban response to this was they were crickets. Right now, there are less U.S. diplomatic personnel in any time in Cuba since 1970s. The Cubans had an opportunity to improve relations with the United States, but they refused to take it.
All right, so, I'm not sure I understand. You're saying that the U.S. embargo on Cuba has done nothing to destabilize the country?
It's the most leaky embargo in the world. Cubans from the United States can travel. The dollar was an official currency in Cuba. Yes, the embargo makes things more difficult for the Cubans, but it is not the cause of Cuban hardship. That's been the line of the Castro government for 60 years.
Well, either way, there's no doubt that this story is playing out here in the United States as well. We're seeing the protests in Miami. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who has long called out the Cuban government, is calling on the Biden administration to do something, to act forcefully. Here he is on a video from his Twitter account.
I've asked them to use diplomacy that they brag about, convene the United Nations, convene the Organization of American States in emergency session, discuss these abuses, pressure or shame the international community into condemning and isolating that regime, and pressure them to be prepared to take action to prevent a massacre, a bloodbath.
Senator Rubio says he wants President Biden to do something. So what options does the U.S. have?
Well, I mean, the U.S. has all the options of a major power. I mean, the question for the Democrats is this is a very political issue in South Florida. One of the reasons the Democrats did so poorly among Florida Hispanics was the feeling among Cuban Americans, Colombian Americans, Nicaraguan Americans that the Democrats were too weak on leftist regimes in Latin America. So I think there's a political issue for the president in far as Florida and other Hispanic communities in the United States. The foreign policy issue is important. Democratic State Senator Annette Tedeo has been calling for the administration to have much stronger policies against Cuba. I think one of the policy options that the Cuban regime has, and they have used when they've been in similar situations in 1980 and 1993, is to create a migration crisis, to export their opposition, and to force the United States to negotiate with them. This is a very important moment, not only internationally, but for domestic politics.
Hmm. I know you say that U.S. policy has not played a major role in the chaos that's happening in Cuba. It is the Cuban government's fault. But I think there might be some who could make the argument that this is what U.S. sanctions on states are intended to do. In other words, create hardship that the people become unhappy, the government becomes destabilized, and eventually falls. Do you think part of that is at play here, that this is kind of what the U.S. government had been hoping for all along?
No. And I think the people who make that argument are just making excuses for one of the most repressive regimes in the world.
Dario Moreno, professor of politics and international relations at Florida International University in Miami. Dario, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's safe to say the Tokyo Olympics won't look like any games we've seen before. They'll be conducted during a state of emergency because of rising coronavirus cases in Japan. CNN international correspondent Will Ripley joins us from Tokyo now. He's on Skype. Will, what's the feeling there with the opening ceremony a week from tomorrow? Are people excited about the Olympics or dreading them?
I think it depends on who you ask. Certainly the athletes who are arriving and the athletes I've been speaking with for our reports are very excited. They're happy to be here. You know, they've been training for an extra year because the Olympics were postponed due to COVID. But for the Japanese people whose tax dollars paid for these multi-billion dollar venues that will sit empty because of a spectator ban, taxpayers who are not just worried about money, but also about their health, with thousands of foreigners coming in and quarantine procedures that are inconsistent at best, there's a lot of concern here in Japan that the Olympics could turn into a super spreader event and put public health at risk.
Tokyo reported 1,300 new coronavirus infections today. The second day in a row, new cases have topped 1,000. And these are the highest numbers since late January. There's already been a cluster of cases at a hotel where Brazilian athletes and officials are staying. How are officials going to keep athletes safe?
And I think it's important to note that that cluster of cases was hotel staff, 8 hotel staff members, not members of the Brazilian judo team that had not yet arrived at the hotel when those test results came back positive. So I think actually there is also a risk for the athletes coming to Japan, where only 20%, under 20% of the population is vaccinated. Even though a lot of the athletes, it's estimated around 80%, are vaccinated. I've been speaking with athletes who caught COVID, some of whom were knocked out of the Olympics because they still have yet to recover a year later. So they're certainly taking a risk by coming into a country with so many active cases, with case numbers that have been rising and surging over the last 3+ weeks.
We know about Olympic rings, we know about Olympic medals, but all of a sudden this year I'm hearing about Olympic bubbles. Talk about that.
So I'm working with a team where we are in our own bubble, on our own floor in the hotel, not intermixing with other members from my same network, from CNN, who are on the floor above us working in their own bubble. So everybody who's arriving at different times is kind of working within their own bubble. We are quarantining at the same time. We were allowed today to go out to the Olympic Stadium for about an hour to shoot some interviews, but we had to submit a written travel plan that the authorities had to authorize, and that had to be done days in advance. We had to arrange for a private driver because we can't use public transportation, and we have to stick to the itinerary because our movements are monitored by a GPS tracking app. We also have to register our health condition every day. And I think I've taken 7 or 8 COVID tests just since I've arrived. So the bubble exists. And yet at the same time, every morning we go down for breakfast where we're intermixing at a buffet with guests from the Japanese public who are doing staycations at the same hotel. So it's a little confusing about how we're supposedly in this bubble and yet still in some ways very close, perhaps too close for comfort, to people who are not in the bubble.
It makes you wonder what the state of emergency actually means.
What it means is that restaurants aren't serving alcohol, and regular Japanese people who would in normal times want to gather and celebrate the Olympics that they've been working towards for nearly 8 years are completely shut out. The roads around the Olympic Stadium were blocked off when I was there today. They put up this giant fence. There were police patrolling everywhere. I've never seen so many police officers on patrol in Tokyo. So the everyday Japanese who helped pay for the Olympics, who are living in the host city, are completely cut off from any participation in the events because there's also the spectator ban, the first ever spectator ban in Olympic history.
Okay, and that means no fans at all?
Well, no fans except for VIPs, IOC members, sponsors, a handful of journalists. You have to apply for a lottery to see if you can get some of the limited seats that are available for journalists and staff members. But right, no friends, no family, no members of the general public. I actually interviewed a man today who spent $40,000 buying 197 tickets, hoping to break the world record for Olympic attendance. And he was just standing there looking at the stack of tickets. He said every time he looks at it, he just wants to cry.
International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach is in Japan. He gave sort of a pep talk to the organizing committee earlier this week, and he had an awkward moment saying Chinese people when he meant to say Japanese people. Maybe he was thinking about the Beijing Winter Olympics next year, but can you just react quickly to that? And has there been any kerfuffle there?
It was interesting because the Japanese translation of his remarks in English, they did not say Chinese, but it was picked up in Japanese media. Then it went viral on Japanese social media. And yes, some people are pretty outraged that he would make that kind of mistake. But on the other hand, it really is. It came across as I was watching his remarks as just a simple slip of the tongue. He had flown a pretty long distance to get here, probably a bit jet lagged. So give the guy a little bit of credit. He really has been trying to praise Japan and Tokyo, talking about them overcoming so many challenges in recent years, the Great East Japan earthquake and the coronavirus pandemic. He actually said that Tokyo is the best ever prepared city for the Olympics and that the Japanese should be very proud. But the one area where they're really woefully underprepared is vaccinations. Their vaccination rate here in Japan is still less than 20%, one of the lowest in the developed world.
All right. CNN's Will Ripley in Tokyo. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.